The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from the Week magazine edition dated April 19th, 2013. Because of the tragedy in Boston this past week, there was big news. In fact, the biggest news story of the week that obviously happened after press time for the Week magazine. So I did decide to go online here and find out some of the latest information about the bombing in Boston at the Boston Marathon. So that's the article that we will begin with today. Law enforcement officials don't have any official suspects in Monday's twin bombings at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, and President Obama specifically urged people not to speculate on who's behind the attack, which killed at least three people, including an eight-year-old boy, and wounded more than 180 others, including several amputations. "We still don't know who did this or why," Obama said Monday night. "People should not jump to conclusions before we have all the facts, but make no mistake, we will get to the bottom of this. We will find out who did this. We will find out why they did this. Any individual or responsible groups will feel the full weight of justice." Of course, plenty of people are speeding by the president's advice and jumping to conclusions, or at least jumping to theories. "We all wonder first who did this," says Michael Tomosky at the Daily Beast. And Tomosky says a little careful speculation isn't such a bad thing. Here are four groups that are the focus of early and, let's be clear about this, sometimes baseless finger-pointing in the Boston attack. The first group, the Islamist jihadists. Now, this theory was inevitable in the worst attack on U.S. soil since September 11, 2001, and it gained some initial credence from a New York Post report that a 20-year-old Saudi national had been picked up as a person of interest. Police quickly threw cold water on that report, but then Boston TV station WABC reported that police are searching for a darker-skinned or black male with a black backpack and black sweatshirt, possibly foreign national from the accent of the individual. Another anonymous law enforcement official notes that the manner of the attack suggests it may have been Al-Qaeda inspired, if not Al-Qaeda directed, says Christopher Dickey at the Daily Beast. That's because the construction of the bombs, gunpowder with ball bearings, and other shrapnel to maximize the damage is similar to a bomb recipe shared by Al-Qaeda on its internet manuals for terrorist attacks. Of course, not everyone is convinced. "Horrific as this obviously was, it doesn't seem big enough for an attack by Arab terrorists," says the Daily Beast's Tomosky. "Everything we know about their M.O., the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the 2000 LAX plot, and 9/11 suggests that they aim bigger." The second possible group being speculated upon is right-wing militia types. Now, this theory, too, was inevitable, and most proponents point to the date, Patriots Day, as a clue. Residents of Massachusetts and Maine celebrate Patriots Day by taking the day off of work and reenacting the first battles of the American Revolution, says Summer Mathis at the Atlantic Cities. But in recent years, Second Amendment activists and anti-government modern-day militia members have tried to co-opt the holiday, which also roughly marks the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. It's also wise in these cases to remember that the 1995 bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City and the bombing at the Atlantic Atlanta Olympics in 1996 were carried out by Americans who espoused extreme right-wing causes, says the Daily Beast's Dickey. There's also the fact that the Boston Marathon fell on tax day this year, and the last mile of the race was dedicated to Newtown victims, says Tomosky. But man, you would have to be a really 100% out there sicko to think that this was how you wanted to make a political statement about gun rights. I think there are dangerous extremists among that group, but I don't think even they would do or approve of doing something like this. The third group suspected is the government. False flag attack proponents wasted no time blaming the government for staging the Boston explosions to achieve their own ends, says Alex Seitz-Wald at Salon. First out of the gate was Alex Jones, who tweeted, "Our hearts go out to those that are hurt or killed at the Boston Marathon, but this thing stinks to high heaven." Then Dan Bidondi, a reporter analyst for Alex Jones' InfoWars, managed to ask Massachusetts Governor Devil Patrick the very first question in a nationally televised press conference, notes Slate's David Weigel. Why were the loudspeakers telling people in the audience to be calm before the bombs went off? Is this another false flag staged attack to take our civil liberties and promote homeland security while sticking their hands down our pants on the streets? Patrick, looking on with a mixture of rage and pity, said no, surely aware that he couldn't halt this guy's incipient internet fame, says Weigel. But the inevitable Boston Marathon truthers will have a hard time with this conspiracy theory. There were too many cameras and witnesses to concoct a really compelling conspiracy theory, and the real-time fact-checking on Twitter has decimated the bad information that conspiracies need to thrive. For example, those loudspeakers urged calm that they claimed urged calm never really happened. And the fourth group, or the fourth suspect, is a criminally insane lone wolf. There's also the possibility that this attack was perpetuated by some local nutcase, says Tomosky at the Daily Beast. I guess I am right now leaning in that least conspiratorial direction. Unfortunately, in our open and free society, people can cause massive destruction with a few well-placed bombs. There's a decent chance the Boston Marathon attackers were motivated by simple revenge of some kind, or by nothing but the disease in someone's brain. There will be, no doubt, lots more coverage of this tragedy in Boston in next week's The Week magazine, and hopefully we'll have some insight by then as to who actually perpetrated this terrible crime. Now we'll move on to the printed edition from the main story section. The first article here is entitled "Obama's Offer to Cut Social Security Spending." President Obama this past week unveiled a detailed 10-year budget proposal that, for the first time, would include cuts in Social Security spending in an attempt to woo congressional Republicans back to the negotiating table on a grand bargain. Obama proposed cutting $930 billion in planned spending on domestic programs and entitlements while raising $580 billion in new revenue through the Buffett tax requiring millionaires to pay a minimum tax rate of 30%, higher taxes on tobacco, and capping tax breaks for the wealthy. The budget would cut Social Security by $230 billion over 10 years by using a different formula called chained CPI to make future cost of living adjustments to benefits and tax brackets. Obama said his budget would reduce the deficit by $1.8 trillion over 10 years and could therefore replace the $1.2 trillion sequestration cuts to military and domestic spending that have begun to go into effect. "I am willing to make tough choices that may not be popular within my own party," he said, "because there can be no sacred cows for either party." House Speaker John Boehner immediately dismissed Obama's budget, saying modest entitlement savings should not be held hostage for more tax hikes. But some Republicans welcomed the president's proposals as the first step toward a broad deficit reduction deal. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina praised the president for showing a bit of leg. Now here's what the editorial said. Social Security cuts are a bad idea, said the New York Times. Retirees will be more heavily dependent on the program in coming years, since traditional pensions no longer exist and few people have adequate 401ks. It's no surprise that the left is outraged at any hint of entitlement cuts, said the Financial Times. But this is exactly the sort of compromise needed for long-term fiscal reform. An agreement to reduce deficit spending would remove the persistent question mark hanging over the U.S. recovery. Thanks, but no thanks, said NationalReview.com. This calculated feint at a grand bargain is just more of the same Obamanomics, a supposed compromise of higher taxes and gimmicky spending cuts that would nullify $1.2 trillion in sequestration cuts. He even includes a brand new universal pre-K program, whose $77 billion cost would be funded by nearly doubling the federal cigarette tax to $1.95 per pack. The budget's only purpose is to generate press coverage about how reasonable the president is. Now here's what the columnist said. Obama has been reasonable all along, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, though Republicans have refused to admit it. Obama's new budget offers the same entitlement cuts and modest tax increases that he's been offering since 2011, and that Republicans have repeatedly rejected for the simple reason that they hate his ideas and hate him. Putting his previous offers into a budget document is simply a message strategy to convince the Washington establishment that Obama is serious. Nonetheless, his offer to cut Social Security is a mistake, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. Republicans will treat Obama's triangulation as a new baseline to negotiate down from, while continuing to reject all new taxes. As a starting point for negotiations, this budget is a welcome first step, said Michael Tanner in NationalReview.com. Putting entitlement reform on the table is not an easy thing for a Democrat to do, and we should credit the president with finally recognizing that we're on the road to fiscal crisis. This budget does little to solve it, of course, but the longest journey starts with a single step. So will Republicans return to the negotiating table to talk grand bargain, says Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com? At this point, they're out of excuses. They can't convincingly say Obama isn't willing to meet them halfway, as chained CPI was actually their idea. And as the sequester begins to bite into unemployment checks, Medicare reimbursements, and national park hours, outraged calls for a balanced deal to replace it will only get louder. The White House has called the Republicans bluff. The question now is whether, as the pressure mounts, they double down against compromise or they begin to fold. The next article from the main story section is entitled Gun Control Bill Advances. Prospects for the passage of a gun control bill in the Senate were boosted this past week when Senators Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, and Pat Toomey, the Republican from Pennsylvania, brokered a bipartisan deal on background checks for gun buyers. The legislation, which expands checks to include online and gun show sales, is President Obama's only remaining hope for gun control legislation to emerge from the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. Other proposals, including bans on assault weapons and large-capacity magazines, appear doomed despite concerted campaigning by the president. This week, Obama kept up the pressure by bringing family members of Newtown victims to Washington to personally meet key members of Congress. The background check bill was expected to reach the Senate floor for a vote after 12 Republicans said they wouldn't support a conservative faction's plan to filibuster it. If the legislative package, which also includes tougher penalties for gun trafficking, winds up being passed by the Democrat-controlled Senate, it will face a much tougher path in the Republican-controlled House. In the 3 months since Newtown, said the New York Times in an editorial, the urgency has seeped out of the search for solutions to gun violence. Even background checks, which the NRA once supported, now face a steep climb. About 90% of Americans and 85% of gun owners support this common-sense legislation, and voting against it would be an act of political cowardice. Gun control laws have only one real purpose, to make us feel better, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Background checks wouldn't have stopped Adam Lanza from killing 20 first graders at Newtown, since he had no criminal record and used his mother's arsenal. Criminals ignore gun laws, and psychopaths always find a way to kill. It's true, said Margaret Talbot in the New Yorker, a background check would not have stopped Adam Lanza, but any serious piece of gun control legislation could start the process of beginning a shift in America's attitude toward guns. Passage of a bill would challenge the NRA's corrosive view that the only answer to gun violence is more guns. The next item from the main news section of the Week magazine for this week, North Korea raises the stakes. North Korea escalated its threats against the U.S. and South Korea last week, and officials in Seoul warned that the rogue state was preparing to test a new long-range Musudan missile. That rocket is thought to have a range of 2,100 miles, making it capable of hitting all of Japan as well as American military bases on Guam. To counter the threat, the Pentagon moved two missile defense ships closer to the Korean Peninsula, and Admiral Sam Locklear told Congress that his forces would intercept any missiles launched toward the U.S. or its allies. In a further provocation, North Korea closed down the Kaesong Industrial Park, a joint operation with South Korea that had provided hard cash for the impoverished country. Pyongyang then urged foreigners to evacuate South Korea, claiming the region was inching close to a thermonuclear war. War with the U.S. is the last thing North Korea wants, said Andrei Lankoff in the New York Times. Its young dictator, Kim Jong-un, isn't suicidal. He is known for his love of basketball, pizza, and other pleasures of being alive. The same logic applies to his advisors, old survivors in the Byzantine world of North Korean politics who love expensive cars and good brandy. To understand why Kim is being so provocative, go back to the murder of Muammar Gaddafi, said Robert Baer in Time.com. The way the North Koreans look at it, the Libyan leader gave up his nukes under pressure from the U.S., which then proceeded to help the locals overthrow him. Gaddafi was then killed by a mob. By threatening to go nuclear, the North is sending America a clear message: stay away. It's China, not the U.S., that Kim should be worried about, said Connor Simpson in the Atlantic.com. Chinese President Xi Jinping this week said he would not allow the region to be thrown into chaos for selfish gain. Xi didn't identify North Korea by name, but it's clear to whom he was referring. China is the nation's only backer, and when your benefactor is this mad at you and you're broke, that can be problematic. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week, this week entitled Margaret Thatcher, A Conflicted Legacy. It is a common conceit of age to imagine that giants roam the earth in one's youth, said Max Boot in the Philadelphia Inquirer, but I still hold that belief because my formative years occurred while Ronald Reagan was president and Margaret Thatcher prime minister. Together with Reagan, the British leader who died this week at age 87, engineered the conservative revolution of the 1980s and showed the world what inspired leadership could achieve. When she rose to power in 1979, the UK was in the midst of its winter of discontent, crippled by strikes and crumbling nationalized industries. The U.S., too, was mired in recession. In both countries, national confidence was waning. Reagan and Thatcher would have none of it. The two leaders forged an alliance with a simple goal, saving the West, said Peter Robinson in the Wall Street Journal. They stood united as they pushed through free market reforms, broke the stranglehold of unions, and pared back the state. When Margaret walked into the room, recalled Reagan's former counselor Edwin Meese, the president lit up. The effects of that friendship were felt the world over, said Kenneth Walsh in USNews.com. Thatcher and Reagan shared a hatred of communism and the daring idea that the West would actually win the Cold War. Thatcher stood shoulder to shoulder with her dear Ronnie as he pumped up U.S. military spending in a successful effort to bankrupt the Soviet Union. Though the Iron Lady had no interest in the rhetorical crusade for women's rights, said Lionel Shriver in Slate.com, she was a real feminist and showed through actions that women could be the equal of any man. Tough, decisive, and unafraid of conflict, Thatcher defied gender stereotypes. Yet she never gave up her handbag or bouffant hairdo. But the Iron Lady wasn't always on the right side of history, said Ishan Tharoor in Time.com. Her cold warrior paranoia led her to oppose sanctions on South Africa's apartheid state, since she viewed it as an ally in the struggle against communism. She once called Nelson Mandela a terrorist. She also defended Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet because Pinochet, when he wasn't torturing and killing his political opponents, sided with Britain in its 1982 Falklands War with Argentina. Then there's the damage Thatcher caused at home, said Alex Perrine in Salon.com. Unemployment and poverty soared in the UK after she shuttered state-owned industries and smashed unions, throwing hundreds of thousands of miners and manufacturing workers out of their jobs. Many never worked again. Her deregulation of the financial industry, meanwhile, lit a long fuse that led directly to the 2008 global banking crisis and recession. The world is better off without Thatcher, and it would have been much better off had she never existed at all. What Thatcher did was harsh but necessary, said Meghan McArdle in the DailyBeast.com. Britain was in steep decline when she took power, and she began the process of modernizing its economy. But in breaking the unions and eliminating the government jobs that once sustained the working and middle classes, Thatcher and Reagan left millions of people poorer and/or unemployed. They thought the market forces they unleashed would create new jobs to fill the void, but it didn't happen. As in America, post-1970s Britain has been a very good place for educated elites, and yet not very good for the post-industrial working class. Until that yawning inequality gap begins to close, Thatcher's legacy will remain incomplete, and those who have to live in it will remain conflicted. Now, from the main story section of the Week magazine, we will turn to the popular column Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for Vladimir Putin, who smiled and gave two thumbs up as topless female protesters accosted him during a visit to Germany. "I liked it," said the Russian president, admitting that he didn't notice whether they were blondes, chestnut-haired, or brunettes. It was a good week for the terminally unpopular, who can now hire weeping professional grievers for wakes and funerals from British startup Rent a Mourner. The company says its actors, who cost $68 per head, will read up on the deceased's life story so they can converse with other mourners with confidence. And it was a good week for Readers of the Week after the U.S. Postal Service announced it had abandoned, at least for now, plans to end Saturday deliveries. It was a bad week for the first marriage after Michelle Obama accidentally referred to herself as a busy single mother during a TV interview. The first lady quickly corrected her Freudian slip, noting that sometimes when you've got the husband who's president, it can feel a little single, but he's there. It was a bad week for Target, which was forced to apologize after outraged shoppers noticed the retailer had listed the color of a plus-size dress as manatee gray. The average manatee weighs about 1,000 pounds. And it was a bad week for extending your vacation after a drunken British tourist forced a plane from Cancun to London to make an emergency landing in Florida when he allegedly took a swing at every passenger who looked at him. When last seen, Sean Kelly was shadow boxing alone in an Orlando jail cell, shouting, "Let's have a go." Now we'll turn to the briefing section from The Week magazine. This week, our article is entitled "The Hermit King." North Korea's young leader, Kim Jong-un, is alarming the world with threats of nuclear war. What exactly makes him tick? What do we know about Kim? He's the third and youngest son of former North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il, the dear leader who died in 2011. Because of the secretive nature of the regime, no one outside of Pyongyang's ruling elite knows the young Kim's precise birth date. Experts think he is 29 or 30 years old, or his mother's true identity. Some reports suggest she was Ko Yong-hui, a former dancer and mistress of Kim Jong-il, who served as the country's first lady until her death in 2004. It is known that as a teenager, Kim was sent to study at Switzerland's $25,000 a year International School of Bern. While in Switzerland, his official biography claims he was a superior student who mastered English, French, German, and Italian, as well as Chinese, Japanese, and Russian. His school records tell a different story. What kind of student was he, really? Well, Kim flunked science and only narrowly passed English, German, and math. At age 15, he was transferred from the elite institution to a nearby state-run Swiss high school. One fellow student remembers Kim as a nice guy who was much more interested in soccer and basketball than in lessons. He idolized American basketball players like Chicago Bulls star Michael Jordan and often shot hoops with Swiss friends. Former classmate Marco Imhoff said the 5'9" Korean was a skillful player for his size who hated to lose. Kim returned to Pyongyang in 2000 and then attended a military academy. Was Kim always expected to rule? No. His older brother, Kim Jong-nam, was originally supposed to inherit the dictatorship, but he embarrassed his father in 2001 when he was caught sneaking into Japan on a forged passport apparently bound for Tokyo Disneyland. The middle son, Kim Jong-chul, was viewed as a little girl by his father and too weak to lead, according to a memoir by the family's Japanese former chef. That left only one choice. Kim debuted as heir apparent alongside his father at a massive military parade in 2010, when many regime watchers noted how the once athletic-looking youth looked and moved exactly like his pudgy grandfather, Kim Il-sung, the nation's beloved founder. The regime wants its people to see Kim Jong-un as great leader, Kim Il-sung reincarnated, said Kim Kwang-in, head of the North Korea Strategy Center in Seoul. They fattened him up and gave him a thorough training and plastic surgery, too, some even say. Is his authority secure? His recent actions would suggest it is not. When Kim succeeded his father and took on the title Supreme Commander, 2 years ago, many intelligence analysts thought he was just a figurehead and that real power lay with the country's network of much older generals. But last year, Kim conducted a brutal purge of senior military officials he viewed as insufficiently loyal. Dozens of officers were executed by firing squad, and Deputy Defense Minister Kim Chol was reportedly ordered to stand in a deserted spot on a North Korean army range and then obliterated by targeted mortar fire. Many analysts believe that Kim's recent barrage of provocations, including threats to wage war on South Korea and to nuke the U.S., are intended to further secure his domestic power base. Why would a crisis strengthen him? Using manufactured external threats is one of the oldest tricks in the tyrant playbook. By creating the impression that a U.S. attack is imminent, said John Lee, the Associated Press's bureau chief in Pyongyang, the regime can foster a sense of national unity and encourage the people to rally around their new leader. If Kim can convince the citizens and the 1.2 million man army of the Hermit Kingdom that North Korea faces a major threat from a hostile outside world, the generals would not dare challenge the young dictator's authority. Kim also learned from his father that playing crazy is an effective way to manipulate foreign powers. During his 17-year-old rule, Kim Jong-il repeatedly threatened to turn Seoul into a sea of flames. Unsure whether the dear leader was mad enough to follow through, the South agreed to supply food and fuel aid to the impoverished North and to create cash-generating investment zones. The younger Kim has tweaked his father's crazy guy in the neighborhood strategy by expanding his war threats to include the U.S. as well as Seoul, even though he has no missiles that can go that far. What does Kim want from the U.S.? He wants it to roll back tough UN sanctions implemented earlier this year that ban the export to North Korea of luxury items such as gems, yachts, and sports cars. Kim needs these goodies to buy the loyalty of high-ranking officials. Some analysts worry that Kim lacks his father's strategic cunning and could go overboard in attempting to prove his toughness. Although he practiced brinksmanship all the time, there was a record of Kim Jong-il stepping back from the brink, said Alexander Monzeroff, a North Korea expert at Johns Hopkins University. With his son, we don't have a track record yet. We don't know what his limits are, how far we can push him, or whether he has any breaks or not. And the footnote to this briefing article is entitled, "The Kim's Sibling Rivalry." The late Kim Jong-il's oldest son, Kim Jong-nam, is still bitter over his little brother's success. Jong-nam has repeatedly lobbed insults at Jong-un since his accession, telling one Japanese newspaper that his regime was a joke and doomed to collapse. He's paid a price for his name-calling. Russian weekly Arguments and Facts last year reported that the Jong-nam was tossed out of a five-star hotel in the Chinese gambling hub of Macau following the sudden cancellation of his regime-funded Visa gold card. Soon after, South Korean officials claimed to have captured a North Korean agent who'd been ordered to kill Jong-nam by staging a car accident in China. Jong-nam fled Macau and is now thought to be hiding in Singapore. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for the week dated April 19th, 2013, here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. And now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. this past week, as reported by The Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, "Obama's Patronizing Giveback." And this was written by Dana Milbank in The Washington Post. For a man worth millions, said Dana Milbank, $20,000 is not much of a sacrifice. Yet that patronizing sum is what President Obama is surrendering to show solidarity with the thousands of federal workers facing furloughs due to the automatic spending cuts known as sequestration. Equivalent to 5% of his $400,000 salary, Obama's give back is meant to equal the percentage by which many federal agencies are being cut. But 5% means nothing to him while it's causing real pain for furloughed federal employees and their families. Whether or not he wanted it to happen, Obama is responsible for sequestration. He created the idea along with congressional Republicans and signed the bill into law. Political fame has already made him a wealthy man, with $8 million in income from sales of his memoirs. When he leaves office, he will undoubtedly make tens of millions. If Obama really wants to share the sequester pain, he should give back all but a dollar of his $400,000 salary. He can earn that sum back when he leaves with a couple of days' work. The next article is entitled "The Latest Republican Black Hope" by Nahisi Coates in the New York Times. Dr. Benjamin Carson is the conservative black hope of the moment, said Ta-Nehisi Coates. The African-American neurosurgeon grabbed the attention of conservatives in February when he lambasted Obamacare in a speech while the uncomfortable president was sitting just feet away. 2 weeks ago, Carson compared same-sex marriage supporters to advocates of bestiality and pedophilia and said black Democrats have a plantation mentality. When liberals criticized his comments, he called them the most racist people there are. Ever since Obama's election, conservatives have been seeking a black hope like Carson, a fire-breathing, dark-skinned Republican who could simultaneously please an overwhelming white audience while inoculating the right from charges of racism. Perennial candidate Alan Keyes, former Republican National Chairman Chief, Republican National Committee Chief Michael Steele, presidential contender Herman Cain, and even former Representative Alan West have all previously auditioned for the role. Carson has been a community leader in Baltimore since the late 1980s, but was ignored by conservatives until Obama became president. When Obama's second term is over, conservatives will lose interest in Carson and other blacks once again. And the third column this week is entitled "Mockery as a Tool of Freedom" by Sreda Pakovic and Mladen Joskic in Foreign Policy magazine. Dictators don't like jokes, said Sreda Pakovic and Mladen Joskic. Throughout the world, revolutionaries are discovering that humor and satire discomfit the powers that be far more effectively than rage and violence. Last week, Egyptian authorities were so unsettled by the jokes of talk show host Bassem Youssef, Egypt's version of Jon Stewart, that they charged him with insulting President Mohamed Morsi. Just a year before, young Egyptians had helped topple dictator Hosni Mubarak by using witty puns, biting caricatures, and snarky performances to make it cool to come to Tahrir Square. In Tunisia, hungry revolutionaries made a hero of the imaginary Captain Kobza, who mocked regime loyalists with a sharp wit and a French baguette. In Russia, dissidents staged a toy protest against President Vladimir Putin, forcing police to arrest protesting teddy bears and Lego characters. For autocrats, satire presents a dilemma. If they crack down, they look ridiculous. But if they ignore it, humor corrodes the very mortar that keeps most dictators in place, which is fear. Now we will flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week, to the last word. And our article this week is entitled "The Food Stamp Nation." Towns across the U.S. have a monthly boom and bust cycle, said Eli Saslow, and it's based on federal aid. The economy of Woonsocket, Rhode Island, was about to stir to life. delivery trucks were arriving and stores were extending their hours. The bus company was warning riders to anticipate heavy traffic. A community bank, soon to experience a surge in deposits, was rolling a message across its electronic marquee on the night of February 28th. Happy shopping. Enjoy the first. In the heart of downtown, Miguel Picardo, 53, watched three trucks jockey for position at the loading dock of his family-run international meat market. For most of the month, his business operated as a humble milk and eggs corner store. But now 3,000 pounds of product were scheduled for delivery in the next few hours. He smoothed the edges of a sign posted near his register. Yes, we take food stamps. Today, we fill the store up with everything, he said. Tomorrow, we sell it all. At precisely 1 second after midnight on March 1st, Woonsocket would experience its monthly financial windfall. Nearly $2 million from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. Federal money would be electronically transferred to the broke residents of a nearly bankrupt town, where it would flow first into grocery stores and then on to food companies, employees, and banks, beginning the monthly cycle that has helped Woonsocket survive. 3 years into an economic recovery, this is the lasting scar of collapse, a federal program that began as a last resort for a few million hungry people has grown into an economic lifeline for entire towns. Spending on SNAP has doubled in the past 4 years and tripled in the past decade, surpassing $78 billion last year. A record 47 million Americans received the benefit, including 13,752 in Woonsocket, one-third of the town's population. The first is always circled on the office calendar at International Meat Market, where customers refer to the day in the familiar slang of a holiday. It's check day, milk day, payday, Mother's Day. Uncle Sam Day, Picardo said late on February 28th as he watched merchandise roll off the trucks. Out came 40 cases of ramen noodles. Out came 230 pounds of ground beef and 180 gallons of orange juice. SNAP enrollment in Rhode Island has been rising for 6 years, up from 73,000 people to nearly 180,000. And now three-quarters of purchases at International Meat Market are paid for with electronic benefit transfer, or EBT, cards. Government money, in effect, funded the truckloads of food at Picardo's dock and the three part-time employees he had hired to unload it and the walk-in freezer he had installed to store surplus product and the electric bills he paid to run that freezer at nearly $2,000 each month. The local unemployment rate was 12%. The shuttered textile mills along the river had become Section 8 housing. The median income had dropped by $10,000 in the last decade. Of the few jobs still available in Woonsocket, many were part-time positions at grocery stores like Picardo's, with hours clustered around the first of the month. Picardo has placed a $10,000 product order to satisfy his diverse customers, half of them white, a quarter Hispanic, 15% African American, plus a dozen immigrant populations drawn to Woonsocket by the promise of cheap housing. He had ordered 150 pounds of the tenderloin steak favored by the newly poor, clinging to old habits, and 200 cases of chicken gizzards for the intergenerationally poor, savvy enough to spot a deal at less than $2 a pound. He had bought pizza pockets for the working poor and plantains for the immigrant poor. He had stocked up on East Africa marinades, Spanish rice, cumin snacks, and Mexican fruit juice. Late on the 28th, a boyfriend and girlfriend arrived. Finally, a customer, Picardo said, turning away from a Dominican League baseball game streaming on his computer. The last day of the month was always his slowest. The first was always his best, when he sometimes made 25% of his profits for the month. Picardo rang up his last transaction of February, a gallon of milk, a box of pasta, and a bag of discount cookies. That's $5.28, he said. The boyfriend handed over his EBT card. Sorry, running low, he said. I only got $1.07 on there. The girlfriend handed over hers. I got $3.20 on this one. They paid the remainder of their balance with change, and Picardo dropped it into his nearly empty register. Picardo closed the register and totaled his sales for February. He had made $526. Tomorrow we do 15 times more, he said. Rebecca and Jury Ortiz usually ran out of milk first after about 3 weeks. Next, when went juice, fresh produce, cereal, meat, and eggs. By the 27th or 28th, Rebecca, who is 21 years old, was often making a dish she referred to in front of the kids as rice-a-roni, even though she and Jury called it rice-a-whatever. It was boiled noodles with canned vegetables and beans. Enough salt and hot sauce can make anything good, she said. For the past 3 years, the Ortiz's lives had unfolded in a series of exhausting fractional decisions. Was it better to eat the string cheese now or to save it, to buy milk for $3.80 nearby or for $3.10 across town? Was it better to pay down the $600 they owed the landlord or the $110 they owed for their cell phones? Or the $75 they owed the tattoo parlor? Or the $840 they owed the electric company? They had been living together since Rebecca became pregnant during senior year of high school, long enough to experience Woonsocket's version of recession and recovery. Jury had lost his job at a pharmacy late in 2010 because of downsizing, and Rebecca had lost hers in fast food for the same reason a few months later. They had filled out a one-page application for SNAP, the food stamp program, and been accepted on October 11, 2011, awarded $518 for a family of four to be delivered on the first of every month. Late in 2012, they had both been hired for the only work high school graduates were finding in a low-wage recovery, part-time at a nearby supermarket, the nicest one in the area, a two-story Stop and Shop across the Massachusetts line. She made $8 an hour, and he earned $9. She worked days in produce, and he worked nights as a stocker. Their combined monthly income of $1,700 was still near the poverty line, and they still qualified for SNAP. Rebecca had read that the average monthly SNAP benefit lasted a family 17 days, and she knew from personal experience the anxiety headaches that came at the end of every month when their SNAP money had run out, their bank account was empty, and she was left to ply Woonsocket's circuit of emergency church food pantries. The government had designated Woonsocket a highly distressed community in 2012, and at night Jury thought it also seemed deserted, a town that disappeared into twisting two-lane roads, shadowy mills, and abandoned smokestacks. He crossed into Massachusetts and cut through a parking lot toward the Stop and Shop. Jury had almost never stopped at the store himself. It was too expensive. He punched his time card at 10:57 p.m. and walked into the store, where he stocked the aisles as February 28th ended and March 1st arrived. The first five customers came to the International Meat Market at 7 a.m., 30 minutes before the store opened. They leaned on shopping carts and smoked cigarettes, passing around a yellow flyer that advertised the market's bulk deals for the first. The flyer detailed 8 meat packs. 5 pounds of deli cuts went for $12.99. 28 pounds of beef for $49.99. A 58-pound variety pack with pork, pig's feet, chicken wings, and London broil for $99.99. Picardo unlocked the store and led the customers to the meat counter, where both the butcher and his apron were already smeared with blood. Every store had a gimmick for the first, and Bicardo's was the meat packs, which accounted for most of his sales. The idea was to sell merchandise in bulk when customers were hungry and most likely to splurge. Hours after the government had deposited an average benefit payment of $265 onto their EBT cards. The nearby Shaw's Market had started a dollar aisle, and the dollar store had 50-cent specials. A part-time janitor came through with a meat pack, vegetable oil, and canned tomatoes. That's $132, Bicardo said. An unemployed welder with two meat packs and 24-pack of ramen. A retired teacher, a single mother of three, a Salvadoran immigrant who wanted the meat pack flyer translated into Spanish. A part-time employee at International Meat Market hired for the day, buying $69.99 worth of meat with a SNAP card during his 20-minute break. By noon, Picardo's shirt was drenched and his feet were swollen. His fingers were stained brown after grabbing and sliding 120 EBT cards in the past 4 hours. The store smelled like meat and sweat, and the aisles were a trail of discarded items. Picardo noticed none of it. His store had already sold more than $5,000, with $4,700 paid for in SNAP. Rebecca went shopping early that afternoon. She wanted to visit at least two stores to capitalize on the best deals. She packed snacks and diaper bags and loaded the girls into the car, a 2004 Mitsubishi Galant, leased on 18% interest for $90 a week. They drove across town to Price Right, the cheapest chain in Woonsocket and the town's epicenter of the SNAP economy. Nearly 150 cars filled the lot, and shopping carts edged into the adjacent road. A city bus had stopped at the entrance a few minutes earlier to drop off 30 shoppers before turning back to pick up 30 more. Rebecca moved through the lot and lifted her one-year-old Jaylise and her three-year-old Saraya into an empty shopping cart. "Please keep your hands in the cart," she told them. "Only Mommy gets to do the shopping." Rebecca focused on the list and calculated prices in her head. She grabbed two boxes of Cinnamon Toast Crunch, $2.49, a 4-gallon bottle of cooking oil, $5.99, and 3 gallons of milk, $3.10. She pushed the kids toward checkout, where long lines snaked behind all 12 registers. Saraya started throwing items out of their cart. Jaylise began to cry. "Damn it," Rebecca said. She pushed her cart into an express lane for 10 items or less and set her 22 items on the conveyor belt. "I'm sorry," she told the cashier. Then she handed over her EBT card, paid $49.20, and loaded the kids back into the car for Walmart. "I can't do this anymore," she said after almost an hour in Walmart. She pushed the kids toward the checkout line. Another SNAP shopper was already in front of her with $230 worth of food on the conveyor belt, so they had to wait. Rebecca paid $168 and returned to the parking lot. She had spent about 2 weeks of SNAP money on groceries that would last 7 or 8 days. And that article, The Food Stamp Nation, was copyrighted 2013 by The Washington Post. Now, from the last word, we'll turn to the Health and Science section of the Week magazine. For this week, our first article is entitled, "Is ADHD Being Overdiagnosed?" The number of children diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD as it's called, is exploding, raising concerns that doctors are overprescribing powerful drugs to kids and teens. The diagnosis rate of the disorder has soared 41% in the U.S. over the past decade, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More than 1 in 10 school-age children has been diagnosed with ADHD, and nearly 1 in 5 high school-age boys has. Those are astronomical numbers, Yale School of Medicine pediatrician William Graff tells tells the New York Times. He and other experts say the increase is largely the fault of doctors yielding to pressure from parents to medicate kids who have only mild behavioral problems or trouble concentrating. Stimulants used to treat ADHD, like Ritalin and Adderall, have become popular study drugs among college and high school students with negligible symptoms. Those who have prescriptions distribute as many as 30% of their pills to friends who don't. The criteria doctors use to diagnose ADHD rely solely on patients' or their parents' descriptions of symptoms. Yet medical authorities are further loosening those criteria, even as evidence mounts that ADHD medications can be addictive. We have kids out there getting these drugs to use them as mental steroids, says child psychiatrist Ned Hallowell, and that is dangerous. And the health scare of the week, the rise of drunkorexia? A scary new trend among college students combines starvation with binge drinking, says the Atlantic.com. Researchers say drunkorexia now affects as many as 1 in 4 college students who diet all day so they can drink at night without gaining weight. In one recent study of 22,000 students at 40 universities, those who reported working out or dieting to shed pounds were 20% more likely than their peers to down 5 or 6 drinks at a time. Those who had vomited or taken laxatives to lose weight in the previous month were 76% more likely to binge drink. Relying on alcohol for calories deprives young people of proteins and vitamins, so drunkorexia, like anorexia, can lead to bone loss, depression, heart problems, and organ failure. Alcohol is a desert of nutrients compared to food, said Mark Peluso, director of the Middlebury College Health Center. People who drink on an empty stomach absorb alcohol more rapidly, becoming drunker faster. That increases their odds of alcohol poisoning or engaging in unprotected sex. Now, as we reach the end of the program for this week, we'll turn to the Talking Points section for a few shorter items. As the population ages and lives longer, dementia has become one of the country's most expensive medical conditions, with $109 billion in direct medical costs in 2010, a new RAND study found. The medical cost of dementia exceeds that of both heart disease at $102 billion and cancer at $72 billion. The pork industry is renaming various cuts of meat to give them consumer-friendly names. The National Pork Board has been given approval from USDA to rename pork chops porterhouse chops, ribeye chops, and New York chops, depending on the cut, while pork butt, which is from the shoulder, will be labeled Boston roast. And for every deceased person who is buried, 4 are now cremated. And in the 2012 elections, African Americans waited on average of 23 minutes to vote. Hispanics waited 19 minutes and whites waited 12 minutes, according to an MIT study. Vermonters waited only 2 minutes, while Floridians, on average, had to wait for 40 minutes. And our poll watch for this week, for the first time, a majority of Americans, 52% actually, favor the legalization of marijuana. Support for legalization has risen from 41% in 2010. And 34% of American adults favor making Christianity their state's official religion. And 32% would support a constitutional amendment making it the official national religion. We have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. I certainly hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.